everybody. This is Kelly Mason and Leslie Carson, and you're listening to episode 3 of our Early Intervention podcast. I'm sure including the word poop in the title of this podcast really got your attention, as it should, because, well, everybody poops. If you haven't read that book, it's a work of art, and you really should check it out. Let's get to it.
Episode 3, But Are They Pooping, is with our guest, the famous dietitian Dana Weber. Dana's been working as a dietitian for 21 years. She spent her 21-year career in early intervention. But before we bring Dana on, hey, Kelly, tell me something good.
Tell me something good.
Okay, this is an act of kindness story out of Louisville, Kentucky from 2024. Larry Farish is a bus driver there, and he noticed that one of his students named Levi was having a rough morning. When Larry pulled up in his bus and Levi was sitting on the ground and he had his jacket pulled up over his head, Larry, the driver, said, "Hey, buddy, what's going on? What's wrong?" And Levi, who was crying, said that he didn't have any pajamas for pajama day at school. Sweet Levi got on the bus and slid down in his bus seat. And so Larry, the bus driver, thought, "I gotta fix this." And after he finished his morning bus route, he went to the store and purchased 2 pairs of pajamas for Levi and brought them to him at school. Larry said to Levi when he gave him the pajamas, "You were hurting this morning. You were crying. So I got you these pajamas." Levi hugged the pajamas to his chest and smiled ear to ear. Larry, who has been driving buses for 7 years, shares he has found his calling and says, "It's my passion because I get to build bonds with the children. I truly love every minute of it." And I just think that's so sweet. I think that every day should be pajama day, and we should also be doing what we love, like Larry.
Yes. Love this story. Larry showed up for Levi. That's remarkable. We've been talking about making connections, and yet here's a story of another one. So thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome.
We're going to welcome Dana. We're so happy to have you on the podcast, Famous Dana. And can you tell us how you came into working in early intervention?
Well, hello, Kelly and Leslie. Thank you so much for letting me be a part of this little podcast party that we're having.
Oh, it's not little.
It's big. I'm sorry. Yes, it is very large and we're going viral.
Yes.
That's happening next week after we talk about poop for an hour.
For sure.
So I came into early intervention after my last year of college. I always knew that I wanted to work with kids in some kind of therapy aspect. At first, I was going to do physical therapy, then it was going to be occupational therapy. There was a period in there that I thought about working specifically with kids who have autism. And then in my second year at KU, I took a nutrition class and I really enjoyed it. It really stuck. And so I marched myself into my academic advisor's office and I said, "Hey, I know what I want to do now, for real this time. I want to be a dietitian." And he just looked at me and he said, "Well, you can't do that here." So my options were locally K-State, Missouri, and Nebraska, and no self-respecting KU person would take a step across the Missouri line. So I packed up my apartment and moved to Manhattan, finished school there. And then in my last year, I completed my internship in St. Louis. I knew that early intervention was a thing because my sister is a speech therapist and she worked in Topeka, Ottawa, and Wellsville at different periods of time. But I just didn't know that nutrition could be a part of it. And when I was at the Children's Hospital in St. Louis doing a rotation, I had just casually mentioned it to my preceptor and she said, "Well, I know somebody who does that." So I met her and that's how I was introduced to the First Steps program in Missouri. Started there, I did that for a year and then added Kansas in 2004 and I've never left. So that's how I landed here.
I love that. I don't know if I agree with the case, but I'm going to let that go.
I mean, the options were slim.
Right. You had to do it. So, well, what does your role look like as a dietitian in early intervention right now?
So I do want to say, just to get started, that it doesn't really look anything like I really expected. Feeding is a lot harder than I ever thought that it could be or should be. Kids are born and they're supposed to be hungry and they're supposed to let you know that and they're supposed to eat and they're supposed to be full and they're supposed to grow and gain weight. This is a very emotional and potentially traumatic routine for families, especially those who have been through a lot. Kids who've been in the NICU, kids with different medical diagnoses. It's a lot harder than I really ever thought it could be. So the beauty of a role as a dietitian in early intervention is that you get to work with such a huge range of kids. I work with kids who are multiply medically involved with trachs and feeding tubes, cardiac diagnoses, lots of GI things, obviously, and everything up to kids who are thriving and doing pretty well, but feel like they are in charge of mealtime, and helping families flip that to parents being in charge of mealtime again. We get to work with so many wonderful people where we're kind of troubleshooting how motor capability can come into play. Can they sit in their high chair? Can they bring food to their mouths? Can they let you know when they're hungry? Can they walk to the cupboard to point to something? Or can they crawl up into their high chair? Or can they use words or signs in some way to let parents know that they need something? And we get to do that in real time with the OTs, with the PTs, with the speech therapists in somebody's kitchen, dining room, living room, wherever we might be sitting. We also get to be inside the family's homes, which I think is really vital to working with families at mealtimes, because you get to see, do they have a dining room table? Do they have a place or a high chair that the kid can sit? Do they have food in their refrigerators? Do they have what they need to be able to have a family meal, or have the resources to be able to get the formula or whatever food that they're wanting to buy? We get to see that sometimes before we even ask the question. One thing I do really like to do with families while we're in a session, after we've established some rapport, this isn't something I would do on a very first visit, but I really love to ask permission to go through a cupboard or a refrigerator to get ideas when families are struggling to come up with thoughts on what they can feed their kid. So we'll just go to the pantry, and there's usually a cracker or a snack or a type of fruit or a vegetable or something somewhere that they didn't think that their kid could eat. And we pick it up, we get it out, and we have a snack in real time. And it can be a really fun way to get them involved in choosing what the child is going to do in that moment.
I'm going to be honest, I've seen you do it on a first visit.
Have I? Okay, well, I must have been feeling really good about the situation in that moment. So
I think just how comfortable I made you feel in bringing you in.
I'm sure that's what it was. Yes, we were all feeling really good about the situation, so I just jumped right.
You just jumped in.
Then some other not family really involved things that I've gotten to do is do speaking engagements with parents as teachers, or do sessions with families through parents as teachers. And then I've spoken at KDEC once. So there's never really a dull moment when you're in early intervention. You're kind of all over the place.
That is so true. Has your role changed over the last 21 years? So you're describing what you're doing now and all the ways that you're supporting families and the things, you know, that it's hard, it's emotional, it's very personal maybe to some degree. You know, when you think back, when you first started, has it changed much?
So the biggest change, I think, organization-wide, is that we used to do everything so individually. So a family would have a speech therapist, an OT, an occupational therapist, and me, and we were never in the home at the same time. So now with the coaching model, we're kind of just a walking team wherever we go. And I almost never go to a visit by myself, because I'm almost always the secondary provider. So that's been the biggest change, just the ability to bounce ideas off of each other. And we've been working together for so long, some of us, that we're really comfortable telling each other when we're like, I don't think that's going to work. Or, yeah, that seems like a really great idea. So being with so many people for so long gives you the comfort to be able to really troubleshoot things in the moment that maybe you wouldn't if A, you weren't together, and B, you haven't been a team for as long as we have been.
So what would the top three reasons that you might be asked to support a family as a secondary provider on the team?
One really big reason is for those kids that have a lot of medical complexity and they have feeding tubes. So that can be helping a family get started from the beginning. It can look like me coming in later, really helping them support with growth and hydration. Best case scenario, we get to see the end of it where they're able to wean off of the feeding tubes, and we're helping be kind of the middle person between the home and the hospital, working a lot with consulting with the dietitians at the hospital or the doctors at the hospital to go through that process, helping with tolerance. So a lot of times kids that are tube fed have problems with reflux or just figuring out the routine of how are we going to do this. So we'll work with routine changes or maybe product changes or even transitioning a kid from a commercial product to a homemade blended diet. I work with families doing that a lot. That's a big part of my job. A second one, just generally speaking, might be helping kids who are struggling to gain weight or grow. That could be because of a medical, like cardiac kids tend to burn a lot more calories than other kids might. So we have to work on calorie packing. Sometimes we're helping them figure out what's going on, watching the growth curve, kind of seeing where we're headed. And we'll talk a lot about how stooling and reflux can get in the way of weight gain later, but that's a big one too. The third one, I think, is probably just helping families work through picky eating and more restrictive eating. So we've got picky eaters who are going through really typical toddler phases of dropping foods that they like, picking them back up, eating them kind of off and on. And then you have kids with more restrictive eating where they literally have like 6 or 7 foods that they'll eat, and kind of helping them expand that and trying to figure out what are we missing in their diet and what do we need to add and how can we help the kid accept those additions to be able to get the nutrition that they need.
Love that. You can have a variety of things that you're supporting families with, for sure. Mm-hmm. So this is the big question. Are you ready, Dana?
I'm ready.
Kelly, you ready?
I don't know.
What's the number one question you ask families, Dana? Or the close question, to number one?
It's really, it truly is close to number one, but are they pooping?
Yes.
Yes, there it
are
is.
Are they pooping?
It really, truly is the question that I ask the most, I bet. It's got to be up there in the top 3 or 4. And I ask it of families that I've been seeing for a long time, because it can come and go. It can ebb and flow. You can think that everything is fine for a while, and then you start hearing things like their appetite just isn't as good. Maybe they're not sleeping quite as well. And you always have to wonder, is there something going on that's making them not feel good? I am admittedly more persistent about this topic than probably even most pediatricians are, because if I'm seeing a child, there's something going on. So if little Johnny down the street, who eats 150 different foods and is growing great and has no problems with their health, only poops 3 times a week, I can probably live with it. I'm not okay with it, but I can live with it. But if you've got a kid who struggles to gain weight, has reflux, struggles to expand their diet, I really need those kids to be having soft, easily, daily stooling with no straining, no discomfort, no pushing, so much so that parents just walk past the kids and they're like, I think I need to change your diaper. I would really prefer for parents to not even know that it happened until after the fact. As kids get older and we kind of get into like the potty training phase of pooping, they do tend to like go hide. They'll go to a corner of a room. They'll try to be a little bit more alone when they're having a bowel movement, but that's different than hiding somewhere because they're having a rough time. And as kids get older and we get closer to potty training, it really needs to be easy, because once they get constipated and they start holding, that causes a whole lot of trouble for potty training in general. So we really want kids to not struggle at all. We want it to be firm enough for them to control it, but soft enough that they don't have to work for it. There is a handy chart called the Bristol stool chart that you can easily Google. And we want a good number four on the list. It's right.
I would like a description of what.
So a description of a number four is a snake-like smooth tube.
Okay.
I believe
okay.
those are the exact words that it says okay. on the Bristol stool chart. Any higher? Any higher of a number and you're getting too hard. Any lower of a number and you're getting too soft. However, I would rather err on the side of softer if we have to, because at least they're getting it out. And we can maximize their appetites when at least they're getting it out.
Tube.
A snake-like tube. Number four. We're going for a number four. Mm-hmm. So when I'm asking questions about this, I will ask them how often, but how often isn't enough information, because they could be pooping every day, but that might not be enough. It could be pellets every single day, and that's not acceptable. It could be pellets one day, clay the next day, a little bit softer the next day, and then diarrhea the next day, which is also not great. And you don't want to keep going through that cycle. We just want smooth number fours as often
number
as
four.
We can get them. Number four. Another question that I ask is, what does the size of it look like? So I will specifically say, do you ever look at your child's dirty diaper and think, oh my goodness, how did that come out of my child's body? Because if it's really big, that can be a sign that they're really backed up. And I'll get into the specifics of that later. I ask about distension and gas, because if they're bloated all the time, that can be a sign that they're backed up. If they're passing gas all day long, that can be because they're backed up and all that's getting by is air, and that's uncomfortable. With older kids who are potty trained, you can see accidents of stool or urine more often than you're expecting. And there's this thing called encopresis that is basically involuntary loss of stool just while they're playing or while they're doing something else, because they're so backed up that all that gets past the chunk is liquid and it just ends up in their underwear. And the reason I'm so incredibly particular about this is because of the direct connection between hunger and constipation. So this was a little tidbit that we learned many years ago when a GI doctor came to our office one day. Oh my gosh, that could have been 10 years ago now, something like that.
Who was that?
It was Dr. Albadoon.
Okay.
And then he came to Buffalo. So when you are constipated and your colon starts to stretch out a tiny bit, which sounds worse than it is because you can shrink it back down. So it gets a little bit stretched out, and then your colon sends a message to your brain to tell your stomach to stop moving. So your colon is literally stuck because it's full and there's no room for anything to go. So your stomach stops moving. So the consequence to that is a reduction in appetite, increase in reflux-like symptoms. So we really want to keep all of that just moving. And I know that in the first episode, Dr. Delgado mentioned 2, 3, 4 times about how brilliant kids are about their bodies. And this is another perfect example of that. Children do not eat if they are not hungry. So there's that old adage that people have said a million times that just get them hungry and they'll eat. So that's not necessarily true in my world. There's a million reasons why kids won't eat. But what we do know very strongly is that if a child is not hungry, they won't eat, because they are so much smarter about their hunger cues than adults are. We will all snack all day long and then proceed to go eat dinner, but kids won't do that. So if they are having any discomfort, game over, they're not going to eat. If a kid is having a hard time gaining weight and they are constipated, we need to address it. If a tube-fed kid is constipated, we need to address it, because a constipated kid with the tube feeding, they have more vomiting, they have less tolerance, they have a harder time gaining weight, and then getting them into the transition to eating orally can be harder too, because again, they just don't feel very well.
Why would they have more vomiting?
Because of that connection between everything just slowing down. So if we have a kid who's constipated, who's being tube fed, and we are trying to give them their full feedings all the time because the numbers say that we need to do that, the likelihood of them not tolerating those feedings is much higher than if they were clearing themselves out every day and being able to have maximum room in their GI tract for all of those feedings.
So you talked about some of those difficulties that happen when kids are constipated with feeding. What are some other difficulties that could happen?
A lot of times we see kids that are constipated just behave differently than kids who aren't. If a kid doesn't feel good, and especially the kids we see, because they can't tell us why they don't feel good because they're so little. Like if you've got an 18-month-old who's chronically constipated and is irritable and whiny and maybe starting to show some tantrums, getting their constipation under control is not going to solve all of the world's problems, but it certainly isn't helping them be their best, because they don't feel good. So it does happen that when we can get all of that under control, we can see the irritability calm down a little bit, and maybe they can just get through their day a little bit more easily.
That makes sense.
That does make sense. Any other difficulties that you see with feeding when kiddos are constipated?
The biggest ones are a lack of appetite and having a hard time expanding food, because they're just not hungry and they don't care. I do often ask the question of families, if you just woke up in the morning and didn't try to feed your child something until they showed you cues, the answer is often, well, they just won't eat, or they will drink a glass of milk, something that's a little more soothing.
Okay.
Because they just don't care.
Yeah, they just don't care. So how do we address constipation?
So in toddlers, we want to look for the most obvious before we go to things that are more obscure, really for anybody. Kids are chronically underhydrated. So the first thing we would look at is, are they drinking enough? Are they drinking a ton of milk and barely any water. So reducing the milk intake a little bit and increasing the water intake a little bit. We could utilize things like prune juice or pear juice as part of it, just to kind of see if that can soften it up a little bit.
The peas.
And then after we get through the fluid part of it, including those juice options. And that can be diluted juice. Ideally, if they're drinking it orally, diluted juice, because we, for the teeth, and we don't want them just really getting hooked on juice all the time. But it is a really good way to help soften up stools. If fluid doesn't work, then you can look at all those pea foods. So the prunes, the pears, the peaches, and then dates, figs, kiwi, plums, pumpkin. Those are, you know, just a handful of things that can be helpful. And it doesn't matter if these things are in puree form or if they're in table food form. It doesn't matter. Then we could look at, are they eating a ton of cheese and a ton of bananas every day? And do we need to pull back on those a little bit and replace those with different options? Maybe we just need to have a cup of water just kind of out so they have access to that throughout the day. And all of these strategies can be used for kids who have feeding tubes as well. So you can put a couple of ounces of pear juice or a couple of ounces of prune juice in their feeding tube. You can put some baby food prunes, some baby food pears through a feeding tube and see if we can mitigate things that way. Kids who are tube fed are often not getting enough water boluses. So really looking at that first is the great first step. After that, you can consider probiotics in some ways. Commercial supplemental probiotics are super controversial. So we don't know necessarily which strand a person needs. There's always the argument that by the time we get them into our bodies, is there even any of the live cultures left anymore? There's some brands that really believe that they figured out the technology to be able to do that. Generally speaking, if it's refrigerated, that's better than something over the counter, but then like not refrigerated. But then there's some brands that say that, you know, the capsules that they're using are really amazing and it's getting into your GI tract before they die. And I'm honestly not sure the answers to any of that. But what we do know is that fermented foods are a really great option. So that can include yogurt. It can include things like kefir. It can include kimchi if you've got an adventurous eater.
What's that?
Kimchi is a Korean fermented, like kind of like a more Korean flavor based sauerkraut is how I would describe it. It's an interesting flavor. Mm. People love it or they hate it. I am not a big fan.
Yeah, sounds interesting.
But some people really love it. So you know what? If you like it, you should try it.
Absolutely.
Really good fermented sauerkraut, fermented vegetables. Even sourdough bread can have some benefit in it because it's been culturing all that time. So if you want to do probiotics, fermented foods are the best way to get it. I have had families that probiotics seem to work. So you can try them. I wouldn't make any promises off of them, but for some people, they work really well if you can figure out the one that you need.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Go for it.
Could we just eat a bunch of sourdough bread?
I mean, you could, but then I feel like you'd get constipated because that's a lot of bread.
I don't like that answer.
I'm sorry.
It is good for your, what is it, micro?
Yeah.
Micro.
It's got all those bugs in it, microbiome.
Yeah, that's a big word. I couldn't say it. But
it's got a lot of good bugs in it.
Yeah.
So eat your sourdough.
All right. I love sourdough.
Hot take. I don't love sourdough.
What about those drinks? You said
kefir.
Kefir?
Kefir.
I feel like they're for adults, but would that be something
kids use them.
Like
yeah.
They do?
Yeah. Kids will drink it. Some kids will drink it. Again, it's a strong flavor. It's an acquired taste. Yogurt is probably going to be your best bet. And there's lots of good brands that have like 3 or 4 different strains that are written on the side of the container that you can find just at any grocery store. That would be a really great choice. You can try a fiber supplement like Benefiber. However, the trick with fiber is that it bulks up stool, so it can make it worse if they're not hydrated well enough. So you really have to make sure that they're drinking plenty of water to be able to support that before you try that, because it can make it worse.
I didn't know that. I also didn't know about bananas until we had a visit together one time, and I was like, I had no idea.
Yeah, the stinking bananas.
I feel like when my girls were little, they recommend the brat diet. If
you have diarrhea.
Uh-huh.
Bananas, rice, applesauce, and toast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So if all of those things don't work, if we can't get through it with fluid, some fiber, some fermented foods and fruits and vegetables, it is a good idea to talk to the doctor about a medication source. So there's lots of options. I'm not even going to get into all of the options because that's a doctor question, but it
we are
is,
not doctors.
We are not doctors. So it is more important to get the stool out of their bodies than it is to avoid using a medication. And there truly are a lot of options. And it doesn't mean that it has to be forever. Sometimes it's just working it out so we can get them to be eating some things that are a little bit more helpful, get them to be drinking some things that are a little bit more helpful, and then you can wean off of it. Your GI tract is a muscle just like every other muscle in your body. So if a child has tone differences, like if they have a little bit lower tone or a little bit higher tone, that's going to affect the way that their bodies eliminate stool. So if you've got that on top of a variety of medications that might be like heart medication sometimes, like if they're on a beta blocker or even calcium channel blockers that some of our kids are on, those can just slow stuff down. So we may be dealing with a whole lot of bricks that are, pardon the pun, that are underneath the problem.
That was good.
That was good. And they just need a little extra help, and that's okay. It's okay to need a medication. We try our best to work through with food and fluid options first, but sometimes they just need a little extra support. So a key thing to remember is if you start a plan of some sort, whether it's through food, whether it's through fluid, whether it's through a medication that your doctor has recommended, if your colon has started stretching out and it started sending that signal to kind of slow your system down, because things are backed up, it can take months for your colon to shrink back down. It can be done. It can absolutely be done. But if you have some, like you start some medication and you have some good days, don't just stop the plan because you think they don't need it anymore, because the problem is that muscle memory just stretches back out. And then we're back to the problem that we were in the first place. And going back and forth like that is just really rough. So just be patient, work with your doctor to do it as long as you need to. I mean, I've heard everywhere from 3 months to 4 months to 6 months to a year. And it really depends upon how long it's been a problem and how quickly you can get them onto a regular routine.
Sounds like maybe parents or caregivers might be stopping the routine.
Sometimes, because you think you don't need it anymore. And who wants to medicate a kid if you don't have to medicate a kid? Nobody wants to do that.
Right. Yeah. Let's talk about reflux. You've talked about that, mentioned that a few times here over the last little bit of time that we've been on together today. What are some signs an infant or toddler might have reflux?
Okay, so there's two different categories of reflux. There's GER, G-E-R, which stands for gastroesophageal reflux. And that's what we refer to as the happy spitter. So it's a kid who eats, they spit up, they seem fine, they're thriving, they're gaining weight, they're growing, they're sleeping well. It's frustrating because there's extra laundry involved, because you're cleaning bed sheets and you're cleaning bibs and you're cleaning shirts and you're cleaning onesies, but they generally don't need treatment and they grow out of it. So then there's the other type called GERD. So that's G-E-R-D, gastroesophageal reflux disease. And this is where things get a little trickier. So these are kids that have more discomfort. They're more irritable. They could have a harder time growing because they're having some feeding refusal because it hurts to eat, or they're vomiting it up more frequently. You might see some arching away from the bottle. You might see poor sleep because when you're horizontal, there's nowhere for the acid to go. So it just kind of stays there, and that can be uncomfortable, and it could cause coughing. It could cause a little bit of wheezing or hoarseness when it gets a little bit worse. It can cause recurrent ear infections. Severe cases, and I've seen this a couple of times, kids will reflux so much that they aspirate on it and then they can have recurrent pneumonia. So that's when you really start thinking about what are we going to do to treat this. And then there's also the older kids. So kids who are 12 to like 18 months old or so, we assume that they've grown out of it by then. So if I'm seeing a kid who's got all of those classic signs of they have a super light appetite, they're disinterested in meal, I kind of talked about earlier the experiment that if you just kind of let them go to see how long they would go without eating, like if the answer is they're just never hungry. And if you ask the question, so when they were infants, did they have reflux? And they say, yeah, but they outgrew it. That can be a clue that maybe they didn't outgrow it. And maybe they're just old enough now that the reflux isn't literally coming out of their bodies. It's just regurgitating up, you know, kind of halfway or whatever. They're feeling a little nausea or they're feeling a little bit of heartburn, and they can't really express that in any talking way, language way that we know what they're doing or what they're feeling, but they're just showing us those little subtle signs. Sometimes those kids, it can be worth talking to the doctor about doing a couple of months of like a famotidine or one of the lower level reflux medications just to see if it makes a difference. And if it doesn't make a difference, then stop it.
Let me ask you a quick question about reflux. You mentioned some of like the physical signs that we might see, like poor sleep, kind of arching, coughing, you know, some ear infections. How does reflux affect like feeding and mealtimes?
So the most obvious way that it affects mealtimes is the way that they eat and how they grow. So like I said, it can make them have a really low appetite. It can cause disinterest in foods. And remember, kids are super smart. So if they don't feel good, they're not just going to proactively eat through it just for the sake of eating through it. They're just going to refuse it. You can start to see food refusal. You can start to see kids being a little bit more hesitant about trying some new things. Those are kind of the classic feeding, the growth, the weight gain, the feeding refusal, like especially with bottles. And then as they get older, just a light appetite and being pretty disinterested in mealtime.
What about like kiddos that, you know, maybe are under 12 months, any gross motor skills like that you see reflux impacting that?
Yeah. So the biggest one is tummy time. So if their stomachs hurt, they really don't want to lay on their tummies. So if it's impacting that, then it impacts all the other motor stuff that comes after that. So we really want to try to get ahead of it and help them feel as good as they can so they can be able to meet all those milestones.
Yeah. Well, you started to talk about it, and I think we want to know, how do we treat reflux and what does the research say about that?
Okay. So again, we don't want to medicate kids unless we have to. So for infants, really what they're talking about doing first right now is doing smaller feedings a little bit more frequently and just don't overfeed them. So doing a little bit less to give their bodies a little extra help in digesting what they have instead of filling them up so full that they just want to vomit. Positioning, like specifically having them sit a little bit upright after a feeding to just kind of let gravity kind of take its course, and really encouraging breastfeeding, because we know that breastfeeding for parents who can do it, it is so hard to breastfeed. But if they are breastfeeding, really encouraging them to continue that, because we know that the proteins really are pretty easy to digest. So really hoping that moms can continue doing that. If they're formula fed, you could try one of the commercially thickened formulas. The most common one is Enfamil AR, and that means added rice. So it's a little bit thicker than other formulas on the market, and that thickness just helps gravity keep it down. And that can help kids. I've seen it work really well in a handful of kids. So that's definitely an option. If that doesn't work, then you could try the next step of formula. They're called protein hydrolysate formulas. And that would be like a Nutramigen, an Alimentum, and Gerber has one now called Extensive HA. And those basically mean that the proteins are broken down a little bit, so they are more easily digestible and tolerated by kids who have possibly a milk intolerance. You can consider in a breastfeeding mom to do at least a temporary milk elimination. So have the mom eliminate dairy for a little while. This is less standard than maybe it used to be, because we are learning that breast milk truly is generally tolerated because the proteins are so much easier to digest. So if you do it, A, you want to see an obvious improvement, because we really want moms to be able to continue to breastfeed and not necessarily have to pump and not necessarily have to do all of these other things to be able to nurse. We want it to be successful. But if you do it for a few weeks and then have the mom eat some dairy again and see if it really did make a difference or not. It does make a difference for some kids, but we don't want to be needlessly altering a mom's diet when they need extra calories and they need extra protein and they need extra fat to be able to nurse. And we need them to be nourished so they have the energy to do it. So if you do it temporarily, reintroduce it and see what happens. And if it helped, great. If it didn't help, then you know. And then it can give the mom a little relief if she doesn't have to do that long term.
Really quick question. Mm-hmm. You know, I know a lot of the families that we work with use WIC. Uh-huh. And I do believe that most of the formula is covered. Is the, if you have to like go down that line that you mentioned, the Nutramigen, is that covered?
It is. So there's Nutramigen is made by Enfamil and Alimentum is made by Similac. So they're two different companies. And generally speaking, it's whatever company that WIC has their contract with. And it may be both. It kind of changes. It goes back and forth between what they cut, like what brand they're using. But if you have a doctor's note, I think things can usually be. I'm not educated on the ins and outs of that, but I'm going to add one thing back into reflux. If none of those things work, then you go to medication. So there's different levels of medication. So there's the histamine blockers that are like the Pepcid. So that's famotidine. And they'll often start with that one first. And then after that is a PPI, which is Prevacid. Prilosec. And then Nexium is kind of above that. And sometimes if you've done all these other things and it doesn't work, the pediatrician will just make a GI referral, which is also lovely. So if we can't do it with formula, we can't do it with a milk elimination, we can't do it with positioning, and we can't do it with smaller feedings, then a medication could be something to consider if they're not improving over time.
Okay. Thanks for that, Dana.
Yeah.
So switching topics a bit, I know that you often discuss ferritin with families. What does this strange word ferritin mean, and why do we care so much about it?
Okay. Ferritin is a protein in our body that carries iron to release it into our bloodstream. So we care about it because it can be an early indicator of iron deficiency. So there's a whole bunch of blood work that can be done. There's a CBC, which stands for a complete blood count. There is total iron binding capacity, which basically means how much capacity your body has to store more iron. And then there's transferrin saturation levels, which means how much your body is currently storing in your bloodstream. So there's all of these indicators that you can look at. You could just draw a complete blood count and see hemoglobin, hematocrit, the size of the blood cells in your blood. And all of that can be perfectly normal because that is the type of iron that we're kind of using consistently. We use it for oxygenating our blood. We use it for our organs to be able to function properly. And ferritin is like the storage facility. So we're always going to fill up the CBC levels first because storage is, it's kind of like your savings account. Like you're going to use your checking account first and you're going to put stuff in your savings account later. So the savings account can be low when your checking account is functional. So you really want to have kind of all of those numbers if you can get them, but at the very least a CBC and a ferritin. So something that triggers questions in all of our brains, everybody here is very well trained to ask these questions. At some point, somebody's asking about sleep. So if a kiddo wakes up a lot, if sometimes I'll ask the question, do you ever sleep next to or nap with your kid or see them sleeping? And do they move a lot? Do they kick a lot? Do they roll around a lot, like really excessively? And if the answer is yes, that can mean that they have restless leg syndrome or a term called periodic limb movement disorder, which is basically a fancy term for they kind of kick and punch a little bit in their sleep, just a lot of movement. That's a sign of low ferritin. So when we're hearing things like that, we pretty immediately ask for that level to be checked because we need kids to sleep. Because if they're not sleeping, then we know that the rest of their day can be a little crummy. And iron stores are just super important for development. So if we're kind of digging at the low end of our storage facility and we're using all of it to be able to oxygenate our blood, we don't have any left over. So we really want all of those numbers to just kind of be in the middle. The tricky thing is in order to get the lab drawn, it's a standard blood draw. So you can check hemoglobin with a finger prick, like they'll do that periodically at well visits, but you have to do a true lab draw to have a ferritin level drawn. And then the next tricky part is that the normal reference range on the lab work, depending upon what lab you're using, can be anywhere from like 12 to 115. So there's this huge gap. If you're looking at it and you're like, oh, it's a 13, it's normal, that's fine. But if there's sleep disturbance, you really want it in the middle. So really educating the families and the doctors or the nurse practitioners or whoever that, yeah, we know that this is technically a normal number, but in order for them to sleep, we really need that to be in the middle and we need to get them on an iron supplement of some sort. And that's the treatment. The treatment is an iron supplement.
Easy as that.
Yes, except...
I was going to say, that can be tricky if a kid's constipated, right?
Because iron can cause constipation and it can cause kind of some tummy upset. There's also a lot of nuance in how you give it. So calcium inhibits absorption of iron and vitamin C enhances absorption of iron. So you want to give it a couple of hours kind of in between options of having yogurt, cheese, milk to really enhance absorption. And you want to either give it with a vitamin C supplement, or you want to give it with an orange juice or some high vitamin C food. There are some options on the market that already have vitamin C in them, which is really great and handy. There are chewables. There are liquids. And there's some gummies, but the chewables and the liquids seem to be better absorbed than maybe like the gummies. There's some chewables that taste really good. There's a liquid that tastes fine. And then the prescription one that is covered by, I'm not going to say that it's covered, but sometimes it is. That one just tastes like iron. Some kids can handle it, but a lot of times they'll try the prescription one that is unflavored and it just tastes like garbage. So even the chewable ones for kids who aren't able to chew a chewable, you could crush it and put it into like an applesauce or something like that. So you can kind of work around that. There's also a powder that I've had a couple families use that it's less flavored of iron than like the liquid is, and they had success with covering it up. So there's options, but some of them taste better than others.
Yeah. All dependent on the kiddo, I would assume.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
So you're not going to have any trouble with the next part of our podcast because your brain is so fast and so smart, but the next part is rapid fire questioning. I was a little concerned about your brain processing speed, but you know, you've really done a good job up until now. So are you ready?
I'm ready.
Let the games begin.
Dana, how much milk should a 12 to 18 month old drink in a day?
No more than 16.
A child that's 18 to 36, how much should they drink?
The same, no more than 16 ounces. And I'm going to add something to this. If a child needs to drink like 24, 30 ounces, 40 ounces of milk in a day, are they drinking 40 ounces because they like it? Are they drinking 40 ounces because they can't eat other foods to fulfill their nutritional requirements? So if they're drinking all that milk because they can't chew, because they can't swallow, because eating is hard, because they're constipated, because they have reflux, and they're not meeting their nutrient needs in any other way, that's a point where you need to consider doing like a toddler formula of some sort so they can get the vitamins and minerals. If they can eat all of those foods, but they're just replacing their calories with milk, then we need to whittle it down and see what happens. But there could be an argument for a toddler formula if they're unable to fill their nutrient needs in another way. Was that fast enough?
Pretty rapid.
Okay.
That was very rapid.
Okay, I'm glad.
Are you ready for the next question?
I am.
Okay. Next question. How much water should a child drink?
More than they are.
I need more of an answer.
If you
took... That was a rapid fire answer.
It was. If they are like a 24 pound kid, let's say you're 2 years old and you're like 23, 24 pounds, it's somewhere around 30 ounces of total fluid. So if they're drinking like 16 ounces of milk, then like 14 ounces of water, 30, 33 ounces total-ish, give or take. As long as they're peeing and it's clear and it doesn't smell like concentrated urine and they're pooping, they're hydrated.
Correct.
I think the name of the game is like, you know, when you go to baby shower, where you look at the different colored poop and pee and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I think that's
where we're at these days.
Yeah. Some of what we're doing. I don't
know. That's a gross game. I'm going to go ahead and say like that game is disgusting. I think we should just go ahead and stop it at baby showers. Okay. So that was it, Dana. You passed. You get nothing as a prize. You just get these audio claps.
They're the best audio claps I've ever heard.
I know they are. If an early intervention program doesn't have a dietitian on staff and the child isn't being followed by a medical team, what are some resources providers could share with families?
My hope would be that for any of the kids that are more medically complex, that they do have a good medical home somewhere, even if they live in a rural area. Children's Mercy is using telehealth in a lot of scenarios. I know GI uses it, the feeding team uses it. So if you have a kid that you're struggling with GI issues, you're struggling with weight gain, they have a feeding tube, that is a very realistic resource that you could use because they can do that from home. So from a medical standpoint, that's a great option. Locally, Overland Park Regional has two GI doctors that are on staff. I'm not sure if they utilize telehealth or not, but that's also an option if something is, if the family is living a little bit closer to the Kansas City area. From just a general nutrition information, there's a great website called Solid Starts, and they have a lot of really great information on food progression. So like how to offer different foods at different ages, what textures to offer them. That's a really great option for that. And then at some point we might do a longer podcast on this, but Ellen Satter has a wonderful, wonderful website called ellensatterinstitute.org. And she has a lot of really great free information. There's a tab on there called How to Feed. And it can really kind of go through how to look at doing family meals. But she also has a shop with some really reasonably priced pamphlets. She has webinars on there for both parents and professionals.
Are you getting paid for this?
No, I am not getting paid for this.
Just kidding.
I am not being paid for this, but I use this website all the time. And it's a lot of really wonderful information. She has webinars on there for parents and practitioners. And there's books in the library. She has a lot of books in the library that you can check out. So that's a really great source of information too. Those are two of my kind of favorite.
Well, this is certainly off topic. Dana, we heard you are famous at a certain restaurant. Kelly and I'd like for you to tell us the name of the restaurant and why you are famous.
Ooh. Okay, so a little context to this. Maybe a month ago, 6 weeks ago, I was at my mom and dad's house with my siblings, and we were going through stuff, as you do sometimes. And we came across a treasure trove of things from my middle school era of life.
Oh, the best time.
The best times. They weren't awkward at all. So I found my eighth grade sketchbook from art class. And there was a self-portrait of me in this eighth grade sketchbook. It was part terrifying and part impressive.
It's very detailed. I like it.
Specificity of which the braces were drawn on every tooth. And the 1991 spiral perm that I insisted on.
Oh, yeah.
It was truly amazing.
Yeah.
So I snapped a picture of it. I brought it home. I showed my husband. And his first reaction was horror. And what is this? And then I explained to him, this was my eighth grade self-portrait. And then his next response was, this has to go on a coaster. And I said, no, it doesn't need to go on a coaster. And he said, yes, this needs to go on a coaster. So our favorite restaurant in Lawrence, 715 or 715, depending upon who you ask, is quirky coasters. And so we went out to dinner one night and my husband insisted that I showed the owner this drawing. And the first thing out of his mouth was, that has to go on a coaster. So my face is on approximately 2,500 coasters at 715.
And wow. You signed it at the bottom.
And if you look really closely, my signature is in the bottom corner, left over from my glory days of drawing self-portraits. Wow. We had dinner there the other night. It exists. It's there.
How do we get one of these coasters? I'd really like to have one. I mean, I want to put it on eBay.
Go to 715 and go to dinner. That's okay. The only way you're going to get
one. Right. All right.
So, Famous Dana, coaster 715 or 715, Lawrence, Kansas. Talking about food, Dana, this is kind of rapid fire. Where would you go for breakfast?
Ladybird. Hands down. Fiesta Cancun.
Where would you go for a fancy dinner?
I'm going to give you four.
Whoa.
Go
715, Mass Street Fish House, Bon Bon. Or Culinaria.
Wow. Lawrence has really changed. I'm sorry. I know like none of these names.
You need to go to Lawrence.
You got to go to Lawrence, man. We have good food here.
Okay. Sorry. Pizza.
It depends upon what you're going for. Minsky's could be a little fancy, but everybody needs to experience Papakino's. But also no. Pizza Shuttle is a valid option.
Pizza Shuttle's pretty good.
Brandy B's. Get some Brandy B's.
Yeah. Well, I feel like we could do a whole podcast on all these different restaurants.
We could. we should. We should go to them,
do
a review, have dinner at 10 different places, see where it lands us.
So I'm usually off topic, but I'm going to be the one that brings us back together so we can wrap this up. Leslie, do you want to go on to the shout out?
As part of our podcast, we want to highlight someone or something as it relates to early intervention by giving them a shout out. And today, our shout out goes to all occupational therapists. April is National Occupational Therapy Month, and we're appreciative of the support early intervention OTs provide to support a child's motor development, grow a child's independence and adaptive skills, such as feeding and dressing. OTs also assess and share information with providers and families on a child's sensory preferences, so the team knows how to best support the child's learning and participation in everyday routines.
That wraps up episode 3 of the Early Intervention Podcast. We hope you enjoyed our guest, Dana Weber. On our next episode titled From Restaurant to Breastaurant, we will be speaking with Kelsey Hare, a registered nurse, and Caitlin White, a SLP who both work in early intervention. I know I'm laughing. Listen, people, this just took about 10 takes to get, so you're going to have to just be okay with the laugh. Kelsey and Caitlin are certified lactation counselors and will be discussing breastfeeding and lactation. Look for episode 3 to drop on May 1st. And you can listen to the Early Intervention Podcast on all of the different ways. Please be sure to follow us.
If you have any questions, comments, or topics you're interested in hearing about, or just want to give us some feedback on this podcast, you can email us.
We want to thank Friends Movement Toddler Services for their support with this podcast. FITS develops, maintains, and funds additional services and programs for children served by Infant Toddler Services of Kansas serving Johnson County. They are funded through private donations, fundraising events such as the annual Fall Ball Gala and Tee Off for Tots Golf Tournament. It's coming up. Get your team together. And through various grants. You can learn more about their work by visiting the Infant Toddler Services of Johnson County website, itsjc.org. Well, it is time to say goodbye. We made it to the end.
Thanks, Kelly, for being a great co-host. And thanks, Dana, for joining us. Until next time.